Senator Todd Young officially launches his re-election bid. A small business grant program moves forward, plus teachers getting the vaccine and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 5th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana Republican Todd Young officially launched his bid for another 6 years in the U.S. Senate. Young's announcement Tuesday came via a short video message on social media. In it, he defends his record, saying he promised Hoosiers he would deliver conservative results.
I believe I've lived up to my oath and kept my word, but more work remains.
The Republican senator highlighted tax reform, dozens of conservative federal judges, and his vote to fund a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Young formally begins his re-election campaign with a sizable financial advantage, more than $2 million in his campaign account. In a statement, the Indiana Democratic Party called Young a yes man for Washington, D.C. Republicans, criticizing the senator for voting against former President Donald Trump's conviction for inciting this January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. How big an advantage does Young have? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is Young virtually unbeatable next year?
Oh, there's nobody that's unbeatable, Brandon. I mean, certainly he has an advantage. He has incumbency and he has money. And he wasn't as bad as Senator Braun about perpetuating the lie that Donald Trump won the election. But he doesn't put Hoosiers and the country first. He kowtows too much to the Republicans in Washington by not voting for impeachment and for doing things like, for example, not supporting the bailout here for all the people suffering from COVID. I mean, if he would do something bold like that, he would be pretty darn formidable. But if he votes against the incentive package that President Biden is offering, I think that's going to be a problem for him. Now, obviously, we need a candidate. We need to fund that candidate. And both of those are always issues. But they don't have Donald Trump on the ballot. And for all we know, they may have some right winger on the Republican side who comes and challenges him in a primary for voting to certify the results of the election that was held and making Joe Biden president. So I don't know yet how this is all going to play out. But he hasn't been as crazy as Mike Braun, but he hasn't been what I had hoped he'd be, and that would be an independent voice in Washington. He's not been that.
Mike O'Brien, it's not ludicrous, certainly, to think that Todd Young might face a Republican challenger, though, of course, as we've talked about on this show before, the bar to get on that ballot is pretty darn high. And if you don't have the party backing, which a challenger would presumably not, that would make that difficult. But would you argue, though, it's almost more likely that Todd Young would lose in a primary than he would lose in a general election in next year?
Short of Mike Pence, I don't know who could run against him and, have the organization, the funding, and the name ID, and the, make the argument they could do a better job than he's done. He hasn't been with the president on occasion. He's been smart about that, though, and he's been thoughtful about it, and he's explained why. A lot of that was around his, most recently was the National Defense Authorization Act that he and the president were on opposite sides of. But, having been in the military and be a leader on those issues on Capitol Hill, he's able to explain why he's not in agreement with the president in a credible way. So I don't think that's a huge blind spot for him. I think the original question, is he a lock for victory? I agree with Ann. No one's ever a lock for victory, but Ann's comment that it's always a challenge to find candidates to run for office, that is a uniquely challenge unique to the Indiana Democratic Party.
At the moment,
Republicans' problem is we have too many qualified candidates running for office, and they tend to run into each other in these primaries. We saw that in the primary that Todd Young came through. in 2016. So, but I don't anticipate that kind of problem for him in 22. He's consolidated party support. He talked a lot about that this week in his reelect announcement, in terms of the local party support all the way up to the state party. So he's in as good a spot as anybody could be to win reelection.
Yeah, I mean, in his official launch, he talked about he's got 96% of the General Assembly. He's got the vast, vast, vast majority of county chairs across the state. He certainly put together an organization here that looks headed to victory. But Nikki Kelly, Mike kind of alluded to this, and even Ann pointed it out. Obviously, if you're a Republican running statewide in Indiana right now, you have a pretty sizable advantage. But does Young have an even bigger advantage because of the way he's positioned himself over the last 6 years or five plus years?
I mean, I think he's handled it well. He hasn't, no scandals, no gaffes. He did prove that he could stand up to Trump when he needed while largely being loyal to him. He's definitely voted conservatively. And so I don't anticipate him having any real problems in a reelect.
John Schwanes, if there is a problem, Ann alluded to the fact that he is voting against, it looks like, the latest COVID-19 relief package that's moving through Congress. Could a vote like that come back to haunt Todd Young?
I doubt it. I think memories tend to be short. The money will be going into people's pockets, largely on a straight line vote in all likelihood. So people will get their money. I doubt they'll go back in 2 years and hold anybody accountable who voted against it. I think I would agree he's in great shape right now. If I were betting on this race, I would say he definitely will be reelected. But to your question earlier, Brandon, about where is the bigger threat? Is it from a Democrat in the general, or is it from a Republican in the primary? I think the answer to the question is clear in his announcement statement. He focused on how conservative he was. He focused on the instances where he sided with the president, not with President Trump, that is, not with the instances where he was at odds with him. And he also talked about how he has shored up his support within the Republican Party, which to me is a clear signal saying, I think I can win the general. That's in the bag. I got it. But right now I'm focused on keeping other Republicans out of this race. And that's where his focus arguably should be.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: will U.S. Senator Todd Young win re-election in 2022? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you whether the state should cut off new COVID-19 vaccine doses to clinics that flagrantly violate Indiana's eligibility guidelines. 67% of you say it should, while just 33% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana small businesses, particularly in the hospitality industry, are a step closer to getting help from the state to recover from the pandemic. A Senate committee unanimously approved a bill this week for a $30 million small business recovery grant program.
The legislation essentially puts into law a program created by the Indiana Economic Development Corporation last year using federal COVID-19 relief dollars. It's aimed primarily at hospitality businesses and limited to those whose revenue is $10 million a year or less. Patrick Tam lobbies for Indiana restaurants and hotels. He says the grants might be too limited.
Just within walking distance here, there's a lot of restaurants that are barely holding on, barely paying their rent. They are over that $10 million threshold.
But Republican Senator Ryan Mishler says he wants the program aimed at small businesses that need the most help.
We either drop the guardrails or keep the guardrails, because no matter how high you raise that cap, the next group's going to say, oh, we just fell outside of that cap. Can you raise a little more?
The bill now heads to the full Senate.
Mike O'Brien, we talk all the time on this show and in good lawmaking about striking the right balance. And here it's between helping small businesses and cutting off too many. Is this bill the right balance as it currently sits?
Well, I think both Pat Tam and Ryan Mishler both bring up good points. I mean, part of the problem with having a $10 million cap is that with a $30 million pot of money, you get like the worst four potentially, and the money's gone. So, or you have these companies that are doing it that have really been hit. I mean, the part of the problem is in finding where the line is, it's arguably limitless. And we went through a period early in this where the Treasury was just open. And now we're seeing an unemployment claims and fraud. And we saw early on that companies that didn't meet this were just going to go take the money and bank it because the criteria was pretty loose. They were trying to get money moving fast, so they want to put a lot of strings around it. But there are clearly businesses, and I hope that, you know, the state and locals can identify who those are, who really need it, and can get this help and more, hopefully, to them as we reopen. The good news is we're at, you know, we have a lot of counties that are now kind of fully moving really close to fully reopening. Marion County is one of them. And that allows these bars and restaurants to start operating at a more full capacity and hopefully recover. And if they can get a little help, that's great.
I want to clarify something. The $10 million cap would be for the businesses in terms of how much revenue in order to qualify.
How much revenue they're doing, yeah.
Yeah, the awards are capped at $50,000. So there would be more to go around there. But, Ann Delaney, I think, you know, Mike brought up exactly how I felt about it. Patrick Tam made a good point, which is when you're talking about gross revenue, a lot of restaurants and particularly hotels way exceed that, but they're living on the margins and certainly through the pandemic are doing a lot worse than that. So does this program need to change a little bit to help those who really need it, particularly if we're talking about the hospitality industry?
This is, it's again, first of all, a drop in the bucket. And secondly, it's another attempt by the Indiana General Assembly to pick winners and losers. We've seen before, both with workforce development and everything else, they don't have the ability to do that. They would much better put money into local communities and, for example, in Marion County, give it to the city and say, fix up downtown, make it more attractive, draw people in as we're raising the limits on who can come. That's where the money can be spent better in cities and towns to make those places destination places that people want to come to. The idea that you could pick restaurant A and restaurant B and pick out which one's going to make it even with the $50,000 is ridiculous. They have no ability to do that, and they're just throwing the money out there as the Republicans under Trump did before. It just doesn't go to the right people. And so it would be better spent in each community making those destinations more attractive, I think.
Nikki Kelly, the bill, especially since as the bill came out of the House, the money for this $30 million grant program came from the state budget. In fact, state budget reserves at the end of this current fiscal year. Well, the Senate committee just changed it this week to say they have to use leftover CARES Act money. So now it's really just codifying what the Indiana Economic Development Corporation has already been doing over the last few months. Should the General Assembly just leave it to the IEDC in general?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really understand the point of it if it's an existing program that's already being done. The bill originally would have used Indiana surplus dollars to try to reach specifically the hospitality industry. And look, I don't know if $10 million is a lot of revenue. It sounds like it to me. But I also think, like, let's say you're running $20 million gross revenue. Is $50,000 really going to make a difference then? So, I mean, I think we need to make sure we get it to the people who are the closest to sort of closure, you know, that could really make a difference between whether they continue on or not.
Yeah. All right. Hoosier teachers can now get the COVID-19 vaccine through a federal program outside of the state's plan.
A recent Biden administration announcement means that educators can get vaccinated through federal pharmacy program sites. In Indiana, that's Kroger, Meijer, and Walmart. Governor Eric Holcomb says teachers who aren't otherwise eligible for the vaccine in Indiana, which as of Wednesday means anyone younger than 50, must schedule their appointments directly with those three stores.
They're scheduling with those three different entities, mm-hmm. directly with those three entities and sites, not 2-on-1 and not our website.
State officials did note that Hoosiers can locate all vaccination sites, including Kroger, Meijer, and Walmart, on a map on the state's website, ourshot.in.gov.
John Schwanis, does the state's continued resistance to adding teachers to their eligibility guidelines risk confusion here?
Maybe so, because I'm confused a little bit myself. I mean, the goal, it seems to me here, is to get the shots in as many arms as possible. Certainly the arms of people who are in harm's way and are exposed on a regular basis to the threat of contracting this disease. And I think educators certainly qualified fit that description. So I guess my bottom line here would be, if you can get a shot, get a shot and do it legally and appropriately. I don't want to bash the state though here, because we should point out that Indiana is probably one of a half dozen or so states that really have stood out nationally in terms of being somewhat logical in its approach to not only acquiring and distributing it, but letting people know with a very sophisticated tool that a lot of states, frankly, are lacking. There are plenty of states, I think, it might be right at the drugstore down the corner, and because of a lack of any sort of digital tool that clearinghouse or information, people might not know it. So Hoosiers can be appreciative of that, that the state has done well on that front.
Yeah, the centralized scheduling system is something that most states are lacking, and that is clearly helping Indiana stand out in getting this vaccine out as best it can. But Nikki Kelly, to that idea of the plan, the state has diverged from the originally stated plan on vaccinations, have they not?
Yeah, originally, you know, we were supposed to go down to like age 65, I think, and then focus more on comorbidities before eventually getting to phase two for the critical infrastructure, which is the teachers and the grocery store workers. But somehow they've decided we're just sticking with this age-based approach. I think personally, because it's easier to verify eligibility, but I think there are some fair questions to ask about why we aren't looking at some of these comorbidities. If you look at Regan Street Institutes, you know, they have the number of cases that resulted in hospitalization or ICU, and it's hypertension, diabetes, COPD, congestive heart failure. We aren't providing shots for any of those people yet.
Mike O'Brien, we've talked a little bit on the show before about teachers and other critical infrastructure workers being left out, but the state, you know, said very clearly, we are focused on getting the number of hospitalizations and deaths down. And to do that, they targeted the people who were most likely to be hospitalized and die from the disease. And clearly, it's been working. The number of hospitalizations have dropped precipitously. Deaths are down. But as we lower the age further and further, is that argument starting to get watered down? Because, you know, we're starting to look at, well, what about those people who are being exposed or potentially being exposed more and more often now?
I think it mattered a lot when this first started. But the argument, I think it's the opposite. I think the argument was stronger when you had 70 and above, that we excluded certain people with it, whether they had a comorbidity or they were a teacher or some other frontline individual. We have moved ahead of schedule every step of the way on this, and it's coming down so fast. The age groups are rapidly moving down. I mean, we'll be. The idea that at 41, that I'm in the next group to be vaccinated on March 5th is remarkable when we originally expected that might be in the summer. And now having enough vaccinations for all Americans by May, according to the Biden administration. So I think this is happening a lot faster. We're putting shots in 28,000 arms since yesterday, right, in Indiana alone. So I think it's moving a lot faster. I think it's taking the pressure off of identifying people that need to be in mass vaccinated, because it slows the system down.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien, you just, and Delaney, Mike just brought up exactly what I was going to ask you, which is, as we are seeing more and more vaccine being delivered and therefore the state being able to move down this the sort of age limits further, faster and faster, is this all going to be a moot point in a matter of weeks in terms of who's allowed and who's not?
I hope so. I think getting the teachers vaccinated is critically important, though, because I think everybody wants the children back in school. And that's the key to getting that done. And to Nikki's point about the comorbidity, as the ages are lowering, a lot of those comorbidity issues will be taken care of by age alone. You're not going to see very many 30-year-olds with congestive heart failure, or COPD. You're going to see the group from 40 to 50 and older with that. So a lot of it will be resolved. I mean, we could have a discussion later on about when the next pandemic hits, whether we ought to somehow think through these procedures and the way we classify the recipients. But for now, we're doing a very good job. And the Biden administration says everybody can be vaccinated by the end of May. That is just phenomenal.
All right. Well, some Hoosiers are finding out money from their state tax refunds is being taken by the Department of Workforce Development to pay off unemployment benefits they received by mistake. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports the department had suspended other types of collections during the public health emergency.
An overpayment happens when the state pays someone unemployment benefits and later determines they're ineligible for those benefits. Indiana law allows DWD to collect that money back in a variety of ways, including intercepting state and federal tax refunds or lottery winnings. However, that can be prevented if someone has appealed the overpayment or applied for it to be waived. Courtney McDonald says she was surprised when about $150 of her tax refund was taken to settle the overpayment she was already making payments on.
I'm glad they did take it. That way I can go ahead and get the bill over with. But I would have liked to know that they were going to take it. I don't feel like their communication is very good.
At the end of 2020, the state reported about $35 million in outstanding non-fraudulent overpayments.
Nikki Kelly, is this the best way for DWD to handle this overpayment issue, which is obviously ballooned during the pandemic as so many more unemployment benefits have been paid?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a particular problem with that. I think if someone already has a payment plan set up, I agree that it would have been nice to, you know, let that person know it was going to happen. I also know of some people generally who have child support that's owed to them, and they're not currently allowed to get that taken from refunds, so it seems a little unfair on that manner. And also, while $35 million is big, I did just want to point out that, you know, in the past year we've paid out like $7 billion in unemployment benefits. So I mean, obviously it's the most that we've seen in a while, but in comparison it's, you know, it's a small amount.
All right, well, I actually want to move on. Hoosiers likely won't be getting speeding tickets from highway speed cameras anytime soon. That's after a bill to create a pilot program for such cameras is all but dead this session.
Republican Representative Jim Pressel has authored a bill to allow speed cameras in highway construction zones for 2 years now. He says its biggest obstacle has nothing to do with Indiana.
It's bad actors in other states that have used similar programs like this, and there's been corruption involved.
Some lawmakers also worry that after the pilot program, traffic cameras would pop up everywhere. Pressel says he's opposed to that and even added language to his bill to specifically ban traffic cams outside of highway construction zones.
But we have to do something to protect not only the workers in those zones, but the motorists that travel through those zones. And we just got to get people to slow down.
Pressel says he'll look for any ways to at least advance debate on the issue through the rest of this session.
Mike O'Brien, this is far from the first year that lawmakers have tried to create such a program like this. What will get this issue across the finish line?
Unfortunately, more death, I think. That's because there's so much money being invested in road construction right now in Indiana, and will be for years since the road package passed the legislature a couple years ago. As you see more, obviously, if you have more workers on the road, you're going to have more people hit. The camera issue is just this ghost, and what happens to it is a bizarre thing to me. It's akin for me like when the breathalyzer was invented. We didn't pass laws saying, wait a minute, that's not fair. You can't use technology to tell me how drunk I am and keep me from driving. And this isn't much different. In the other states that have done that, I think it's really been a deterrent. You've seen speeds come down, and unfortunately, the situation is just going to have to get worse before there's an urgency of the legislature to do something significant like this about it.
And Delaney, this is not a partisan issue. There are Republicans for it and Republicans against it, and Democrats for it and Democrats against it. What do you think it will take to get the legislature on board with even a pilot program, which is four cameras around the state for something like this?
Well, I think Mike's right. Unfortunately, I think it's going to take more deaths, and that's really reprehensible. We need to do something to protect those workers, especially when we're putting more of them on the highways. This is a very minimal thing to do. The idea that you have some privacy when you're riding on a state highway and you're driving a car with a license plate number on it and all of that, you don't have any privacy rights there. And it should be about protecting the workers. I think this is the right idea. He can assuage the concerns by limiting it to highway construction zones, but you need to do something. I mean, I've been out on those highways, and it doesn't matter whether the lights are flashing or not. People are zooming by, not just at 60 or 65, but at 80 and 90 miles an hour. And God help those people working there, because it's pretty darn dangerous.
And as Pressel and other advocates of this point out, you actually see more driver and vehicular injuries and deaths in work zones than you even see of the workers. So this is trying to protect everybody, but, well, we'll see. Finally, we learned not too long ago that Mike Pence's post-vice presidential career will include a podcast. And, Delaney, what would be a good name for Mike Pence's podcast?
Mike Pence's podcast. How about Preacher Pence?
Preacher Pence. Mike O'Brien, have you got a name?
A common Pence, not the Thomas Paine.
I thought he should do it with his wife, Karen, and it's my two pence. But that's, I don't know, that's just me.
Or maybe it's Mama and me.
Mama and me? Mother and me. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, wear a mask, and if you can, please try to get vaccinated and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.